to Tabletop Game Talk, On Topic, a show where we talk about tabletop gaming topics of all kinds. I'm one of your hosts, Fletcher.
I'm Kitty.
And I'm Chris.
Today we're talking about the industry disruptors, including Kickstarter, Amazon, eBay, and YouTube. How are these things good or bad for the industry as a whole, and how do they affect our local game stores?
But first, a thank you to our Patreon friends of the show, George Gia, Adam Harrison, the SGC, and Thomas Acciaretti. And welcome to our newest patrons, Don Gilstrap and Aaron Moore. And thank you to Christopher and Michael, who have updated their pledges to our new levels. And thank you to all of our other patrons as well. Whew. All right. This is Peek Behind the Curtain. We've always been full Peek Behind the Curtain. This is 24 hours.
There is no curtain.
There's no curtain. We have no curtain to look behind. This is 24 hours after the last episode. So you guys are hearing this a week after. We are doing this a day after. So all of those
24 hours.
A little less, yeah. So all of those patrons were as of today, which means if you did patron us or join us in the last week, we did not forget you. You just did it after 8:45 on a Tuesday. So, but thank you. Thank you for doing that. And I can't wait to get to, 65 members?
Yes. Well, yeah.
And then we're going to be giving away Wanderer. I got to get the... I always forget the name of the subtitle. It's Wanderer, The Cult of Barnacle Bay, which is a kind of a cross between Zombicide and Arcadia Quest. It's a full co-op with leveling up, and I haven't got a chance to play it yet, but it looks so cool and I want to play it and it's going to make me happy, but I have an extra copy, so I'm going to give it away to someone, and we'll do that in episode 140 or whatever episode has us be at 65 Patreon backers. Okay.
It sounds like a water park.
It is anamorphic. Anamorphic.
Not a word.
Anthropomorphic.
Sure. It's a bunch of little...
That word that we can never say. Fletcher, we're going to have to put you on it.
Anthropomorphic.
There you go. It's like this is where we have you on the podcast now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's anthropomorphic is the word.
It's animal people running around, you know, fighting off basically crosses between water things. So a shark and a bear get together and terrorize the city, and you're running around as a raccoon trying to stop them from terrorizing the city. It makes perfect sense when you see it.
Okay.
And it's cool. Just saying.
There's no twisty slides.
No twisty
slides. Or the wacky cyclone.
No wacky cyclones. But there's just adventuring and trying to... I will do a full playthrough this week. I'll
just have to take your word for it that it's fun then.
It's got to be fun. It's made by one of the designers that worked for Cool Mini or Not, who did Zombicide and Arcadia Quest. So they just mashed those two things together and made it a full co-op. How can it not be good? All right. This is going to be a long episode. Last week was a long episode. This week will probably be a long episode. What's always funny is we don't know at this point if it's going to be a long episode. So we're telling
Chris is just speculating.
We're just speculating. We're telling our listeners.
I'm hoping to prove him wrong. I'm just not going to respond to anything he says to keep it in your time limit. You're welcome, listeners.
No, you can't. You can't frame me in. That's impossible. But like they're looking at their phone and like, 1 hour and 28 minutes. Of course it's a long episode. Or I'm saying it's a long episode. It's like, it's 42 minutes. And either way, someone's going to be unhappy about this.
I don't know why you make these predictions at the top of the show.
I don't either. And I don't edit them out either. I should. I was going to edit some stuff out of the last episode. I'm like, no, not doing it. It's going in raw. Okay. Kickstarter, Amazon, eBay, and YouTube. Also, I think I put a bonus in here that we're going to talk about at the very end. Should we do these backwards? Because I feel like if we start talking about Kickstarter, that's going to be
all we talk about. Because that's all we get so wrapped up in Kickstarter.
Yeah. Let's
okay.
Let's start out with eBay. Because
okay.
I don't know if this one is all that controversial. Christopher Dong. Christopher, you're amazing. The amount of thought that he put into the BGG input thread is incredible. I have a few excerpts from them. But again, as I say, if you want to see the full everything Christopher wrote, anyway, then you should go to the BGG forum. It's tabletopgametalk.com/BGG. Scroll down to future topic, industry disruptors, and there's lots of well thought out stuff there. There will also be a feedback thread in there by the time you hear this. So I'm going to start out. We're going to start with what he has to say here, because I think this is kind of a good place to start. My take on eBay is that it is effectively a marketplace for board games, both in the primary and secondary markets. Yes, there are outliers. Stories, astonishing prices, or astronomical prices, etc. But they are just that, outliers. You can shake your head at some of the listed prices, but that doesn't mean that that's the price it'll be bought for. So if you're having a buy it now price for some crazy price, if it gets bought at all, you can say the same thing about some of the prices on Amazon. The auction side of eBay certainly has a greater potential for extra high prices for bidding wars, etc. But buy it now and storefronts are making it more of an online store. Have you guys used eBay in the past 2 years?
No.
For board games?
For anything. No.
For anything, yes.
All right.
Actually, that's a lie. I have. For anything.
Okay. So what is your experience with eBay? Why would you go to eBay?
Low price.
Really?
I was looking for a really weird and obscure baking tool. It was an antique.
Did you find it?
I did. There were a bunch of them made in the 70s. It was a Krumkach waffle iron. They have like fancy patterns. It's a really weird thing.
Okay. But that's a good point. Fletcher, what were you looking for?
You know those big speakers that I have?
Yep.
That.
And you found them for cheaper than you normally would have.
Yeah, it was actually through the brand. They have they sell their own like refurbished products through eBay. Like that is their storefront. Through certified refurbished, the brand was Polk. They're Polk speakers, and they have their storefront through eBay. And that's how I got those giant speakers that I have.
And have you guys ever bought or sold any game things ever?
No.
Bought or sold game things on eBay?
Yeah.
Or ever?
On eBay ever?
No.
Okay, so I will come at this from my point of view, which is, and you guys can question me on this, which is every once in a while I get a bug. And I need to collect everything of a particular something. I'll go to Amazon first and say, okay, what do we have on Amazon? What can I get? And try to, you know, check off everything. Or sometimes Amazon is a list of things I need. And then I go to eBay and I start searching. And I find things like Arcadia Quest promo figures for $100 for a single figure. And I'm like, well, that's a little bit crazy. But there's only one listed and I have to have it and I can't find it anyplace else. So maybe I should do that. So then I go and I sell a Magic card for $400 because I have these Magic cards lying around and they're worth a bunch of money. So I sell this and I will buy this. And eBay allows me to do that in a way that is crazy easy that I don't think you could do anyplace else. There's a BGG marketplace. I've never even thought of going there, although I did buy something from it once. But I think that's because the only
thing. So you've never thought of going there except that one time that you bought something.
Something referred me to it. It was like I was looking for a particular roll and write that hadn't been released yet in mass, and someone referred me to, hey, they have it over here at this marketplace. And I'm like, and I clicked on the link. And I'm like, oh yeah, I can see that. So much so that when I put it in an offer, I completely forgot about it. And it wasn't until like a week later when I checked my Geek Mail, it was like, hey, are you still interested in this? I'm like, oh yeah, sorry, here, I'll send the payment right away. And but it's just I don't think about BGG's marketplace as a place to go. And it's certainly not a place I would go to sell something because you want volume. You want eyes on these things if you want to sell for good prices. So if you listened to the Dice Tower news, you know that a copy of Wingspan went for $1,025 on eBay, like four or five. Well, I guess as you listen to this, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, like 2 weeks ago. Uh-huh.
What do we think about this?
It's fine.
It's insane.
All right. We'll go with the insane viewpoint first. Why is that insane?
Because it is a game that they are in the process of printing like 30,000 more copies of this game. And if you wait 2 weeks, it will be a $55 game. Plus, I think there was the, $30 add-on bits?
Yeah.
So, yeah. What is the... How desperate is your need for Wingspan that you are willing to pay,
$1,075, yeah. $995 upsell.
Right, $995 to get it within 2 weeks faster, like, that just to me seems crazy. Now, if they were not printing more Wingspans, if this was the only way you could ever get Wingspan again, fair. But, like, the level of impatience on these things seems like, what?
All right, Fletcher, you said it's fine.
Yeah. I mean, someone buying a copy of Wingspan for $1,025 doesn't affect me at all. So what do I care? I mean, there's, I do think it's weird that someone would spend that much money when they're making more. You know, you've heard of people that, you know, they have more money than sense. So they're willing to pay $900 to get the game 2 weeks faster. That's fine.
Well, and I'm pretty sure the game wasn't listed for $1,000+. Like, right, it was just bid up to that amount.
Sure. Some of it has to do with winning, too. Like, I want to win this.
Yeah. Well, and so it wasn't just Wingspan. It was Wingspan plus the Meeple token or Meeple Source upgrade kit.
Yeah.
So it was a retail of about $80, $85, somewhere in that range. But there were at least two people that were willing to pay over $1,000 for this game because of the bidding war back and forth. That did prompt a number of other auctions go up with the exact same thing. And the last I looked, they were around $300 or $400.
Right. Because people were like, oh my God, I didn't know I had $1,000 sitting in my cabinet.
Right.
I like the game, but I don't like it that much.
Yeah. Well, and for me, I kind of agree with you, Fletcher, where it doesn't really matter. It doesn't hurt me unless I want it. Unless I want a copy as well. And then I'm like, wait, I have to spend how much for this game? But on the same...
You just wait longer.
Exactly. You know, I had
the same thing with iPhones or, you know, when the new iPhone drops typically, like, or any new smartphone, like it's sold out. You can't get it, but you can go online and there it is on eBay for twice the price. So how badly do you want it? Do you want to wait 4 weeks or do you want it right now?
Yep. And that's really what you're doing. You're paying for that privilege of having it just a little bit sooner than somebody else. In some cases, a lot sooner. You know, maybe Wingspan's going to, the next copy is going to sell out. Terraforming Mars was kind of in a similar boat where, you know, it was almost impossible to get for the first 6 months because they just couldn't make enough copies. And they just so underestimated the demand. You know, Wingspan could be the same thing. Another similar thing, Keyforge. It came out last November, I believe, sometime around that. And within about a week and a half, 2 weeks, a deck had sold for $2,000. Now, these decks are typically $10.
So these ones, I think it's a little bit different. A lot of the decks that were going for over $2,000, it wasn't just, I can't get my hands on a deck, so I'm going to spend $2,000 on any deck. These are mostly ones that were rare. They had a rare assortment of cards. They had Mavericks. They had Horsemen. They had something else going for them other than just, it is a Keyforge deck.
Yeah.
Well, in this... I'll give it makes a little bit more sense to me, but I still am not going to like jump on eBay and go start buying stuff or trying to sell my rare stuff.
Well, this case I did. So in fairness, this was the only deck I know of that went for even over $1,000. It was a double Horseman deck. So it was a relatively, it was very, very rare at the time, but it was a new game. So there weren't a lot of these out there. Most of the decks that went for high prices were in the $200 to $300 range, but pure speculation. Like nobody knew how rare these things were going to be. I opened up a single Horseman deck, single set of four Horsemen, and I immediately put it on eBay and made $100 in a few days. You know, I paid $9 for it. I sold it for $100 because it was just crazy. Why not? I wish I would do that more often. Oftentimes, I'm like, I'm going to speculate that this is going to be worth money. And I buy it, and then it is worth money, and then I miss the curve. And then suddenly, I have something that's no longer worth anything because I just waited too long, which is sort of the whole thing with eBay. It's a speculative market, right? If you're going to buy and sell and make money, that is what you need to hit the right curve in there. Otherwise, you have a problem where you have something that is actually valuable, but the demand isn't there enough where you just have to keep relisting it until someone finally says, oh, you have this available. Or you have, you know, if you do it too late, too many people are selling it and it drives down the prices for everything. So now it's like, you know, I spent $1,000 for Wingspan. I was going to resell it for $2,000, but now it's only $55 because they made more, which can happen.
So I don't know about this, but I was just listening to this Planet Money episode and I am curious to hear if you know anything about it. Is dropshipping a problem through eBay with board games, or is that just the same dropshipping thing that eBay always has?
eBay has storefronts on it. And anytime there's a storefront, there is the potential of dropshipping behind it. So essentially the way this dropshipping works, if people aren't familiar, people can sell things on eBay that they don't actually have. So what happens is you buy it from them, and oftentimes they buy it from Amazon and have it shipped directly to you, hence the drop shipping. So I want to get a copy of Wingspan's probably a bad example because you don't want to sell something that is going to run out of stock.
Is rare.
Right.
Yeah.
But something that's very popular, Star Wars Monopoly. I'm going to sell it on eBay for $25. Well, I can get it on Amazon for $15. And I have Prime on my account. And Amazon will ship Prime anywhere. It doesn't need to go to my address. So you buy it from me and $25 on eBay. I go and buy it on Amazon and have it shipped directly to you. Boom, bang. I've just made $10. There's software for doing this. And there's all kinds of, you know, shenanigans.
Usually
and
the margins are pretty low.
Yeah. Yeah. Because as soon as people catch on that you can do that, you have all of these competing storefronts all over. So you have to be on top of this on a really regular basis to make something like that work. And I don't know that board games have the demand necessary to make it profitable for dropshippers. And this end of the story is basically check eBay and Amazon and all of your online game stores. If you're going to buy something online, check your prices in multiple places because you're going to get a better price if you at least check three or four different places.
Are you saying that Amazon if I shop around,
Cool Stuff Inc.
I can get a better price?
That is my, that's my best advice. Boom. Podcast over. 17 minutes, we're
Here's the thing. That's the whole thing that the Planet Money, you know, conclusion came to, is like, they were saying, whose fault is this? Is this Amazon's fault? Is it eBay's fault? No, it's your fault. It is you, the consumer, who is not checking the price. Because the problem for a lot of retailers is that they will then get the box from Amazon. The consumer gets the box from Amazon, says, oh, I can buy this on Amazon, goes and looks at the price, returns it to eBay, and then goes and buys it on Amazon, and it costs the Amazon store twice as much and all the fees.
Yeah. Well, all right. So what do we think, just to get back to eBay for a moment, good or bad for the industry?
It's good.
I think it's good.
All right. I agree. I think even those crazy prices, they're fun stories to tell. They make mainstream news. You know, when something crazy things happen on eBay, that gets out into the mainstream. If someone says a copy of Wingspan sold for $1,000 on eBay, you'd be like, Wingspan, what's that? Do I need it?
Yeah. The only problem is when it, I think, sometimes draws negative attention to a publisher. I think that like Stronghold Games and Stonemaier Games have both gotten a lot of flack for underestimating demand of their games here with Terraforming Mars and Wingspan, that it does draw kind of a negative light to them in the industry. Well, but overall, I think it's good.
Yeah, and CMON
more than bad.
You know, CMON with all their Kickstarter exclusives, and we will talk about Kickstarter ad nauseum in a little bit.
I don't think that's bad. I think that CMON like allows as many people as want to order those Kickstarter exclusives. And if you like, it's, I think that that's where the aftermarket is perfectly fine. Yep. If people want to pay extra for those things, this is what eBay's for.
Yeah. And I completely agree. And I think it's healthy and like, well, I would have backed that game or I wanted that game, but I couldn't get the promos. Like, well, you can, but because you missed out or chose not to be involved in that early run, you basically, it's like you didn't buy a stock when it was low and then it went high. And if you still
now
want
you
that
gotta
stock,
buy high.
You got to buy high. So I don't know. I like eBay a lot. I don't use it a ton. I have a whole list of things that I it's literally on my to-do list, been there for 2 months, of things I want to put on eBay and just kind of get rid of them. But when I do, I'm going to be glad that eBay's there. It gives a lot of ability for me to unload the things I don't want and pick, more importantly, pick up things that I do want. All right, let's go to Amazon since it seems like we really want to talk about Amazon.
We did sway into Amazon a little bit there.
Yeah, but let's get a little excerpt from Christopher first before we go too far into this. He says, for game publishers, Amazon is probably a net positive for them. Moving product is what they need to have happen, and Amazon does that. Yes, Amazon may be hurting the non-Amazon online game stores and likely local game stores, but as their presence in the market results in more sales than are lost by online game stores that go out of business, it makes up for the publisher's need. So, actually, there's one other point he brings up here. The counterfeit game problem and Amazon's role in unintentionally facilitating their sale is likely to cause some friction between them, but will result in very little change given the competitive size of Amazon and board game publishers. So first, let's talk about the counterfeiting on Amazon. Are you guys familiar with how this works and why this works?
No, nope. I'm not.
Okay. So what happens? when a company wants to sell something on Amazon, you get, when you're on Amazon, there's a lot of saying things that say fulfilled by Amazon.
Oh, okay. In this term, okay, yes. I'm familiar.
So fulfilled by Amazon essentially means whoever is selling this has already sent all of their product to an Amazon warehouse. And when a particular person buys it, Amazon's the one that actually does the packing and the shipping out. Well, as a publisher, I might send, you know, 200 copies of Terraforming Mars to Amazon and say, okay, these are things I'm going to sell on your site. And when I sell one, you're going to ship a game. Well, I can be also a Chinese counterfeiter. No offense to Chinese counterfeiters, just where mostly they come from. And I can send 200 counterfeit copies. Well, all of these copies to Amazon look like Terraforming Mars, and they all get mixed together. So even though on Amazon I'm buying from Stronghold Games and not, you know, copycat.com, I could be getting a copycat.com. I shouldn't have picked that name to
use as like alliteration. Gotcha.
But I could be getting a counterfeit copy because Amazon's like, Terraforming Mars is Terraforming Mars, and we're just grabbing one and shipping it out. So counterfeiters in Amazon is a huge issue for publishers, especially for those big games.
It goes beyond that, though, because there's also ones that are not shipped and sold by Amazon. It's just they use Amazon as a storefront.
Yep.
So it looks like everything looks super legit, and, you know, for the most part, it is in most cases, but it's actually not shipped by Amazon. It's a third party that is shipping it to you. They're using Amazon as a storefront. That's why, yep, if you know, peruse Amazon, you'll see six listings for the exact same thing. It's because one's from Amazon and five others are from third party sellers.
Yeah. And those third party sellers could be local game stores and oftentimes
could be legitimate. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Now, and that's, yeah,
it's hard to know because a lot of these counterfeiters, they're not putting up pictures of the counterfeit objects. They're putting up real pictures. It looks really official, yeah, and it's very hard.
Yeah, it's stock photos.
To know what you're getting into.
Yep.
Yeah.
So they're pulling the photos off of the game publisher's website and, you know, selling them that way. But that is one of the advantages to Amazon. So I have a local game store, and he doesn't sell anything online yet, but he would like to. The problem is there's a barrier to entry to selling things online. First of all, you got to get interstate, countrywide trademark for your game store so you can sell like that. But that's only one barrier. The other one is the e-commerce platform. Well, if you use, mm-hmm, Amazon as your e-commerce platform, then you're a local game store that now gets to benefit from all of the infrastructure that Amazon can provide you for essentially, it's not free. They're taking a cut. They're taking their cut, but
yeah,
it's way cheaper than what you have to pay if you spun it up yourself. So now you have this ability to have an online presence without having to go and have an online store. Now, what I'm interested in, because I don't know personally any game store that does this. I have bought from a number of game stores on Amazon, though. I'm interested to know what is, you know, that return on investment. Is it worth doing that? Is the sales high enough versus, you know, something like Cool Stuff Inc. or Miniatures Market, which are online game stores that have also local presence. You know, they're going their own full retail versus an Amazon presence. But I don't know about those. So my question, have you guys ever bought anything off of Amazon?
Yes.
Have I bought anything off of Amazon? Yes. I have bought.
Do I breathe? Yes.
I think I get more Amazon boxes. I don't know. I probably get 3 or 4 shipments from Amazon every week. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I
have the Amazon credit card. I do the subscribe and save. I bleed Amazon.
Yep. I've had Prime since Prime was a thing. Like,
yeah.
Okay. So board games. How often do you buy games off of Amazon?
Occasionally.
And why would... Go ahead.
I was going to say, I've never purchased a game off of Amazon, a board game, but Carmen has once.
Okay. So why would you buy a game off of Amazon versus someplace else?
Usually the games that I've purchased off Amazon are not really specialty games. They're games that, like, I could have gone to Target and purchased. They're games that are put out by really large publishers, and I don't feel like I'm hurting a small business by purchasing something like Pandemic, I think I bought online, or I can't remember the other one, but the ones that I've bought through Amazon, they're like, you know, Ticket to Ride, I think I picked up on Amazon for, they're like gifts. They're usually like, oh, I need it right away. I need the specific thing. that kind of stuff.
So, and I'm assuming Carmen bought something because she didn't really know where else to go to buy a particular game. It was just easier?
Yeah, I think she got it as a gift. And I don't know if she had it like shipped and sent there or she just like didn't know where to go and just had it like shipped to her. Shipped here. I forget exactly what happened. Yeah.
See, I'll buy a lot of things off of Amazon. Mostly, actually, role-playing books I'll get off of Amazon because they tend to be just a fraction of the cover price. So if the cover price is $50, I can get it on Amazon for $30, sometimes less. And local stores just can't keep up with that, especially when oftentimes Amazon doesn't charge tax. Of course, when I'm doing my taxes, I pay for all of untaxed Amazon items, as everybody does. But
everyone does.
Everyone does that, of course. But it's sometimes it's so much cheaper that I have a hard time justifying going in and buying from a local game store. And then my conscience gets to me and I go in and buy the exact same thing from the local game store because I'm like, well, I need a second copy anyway. And it's pretty because now it's in my hand.
See, I go the opposite route of, well, I purchased this thing from Amazon, so I'm going to go buy something different from the local game store. I'm going to go find a new thing. And I like going to the game store for some, like, for different reasons than I like shopping on Amazon. If I need a specific thing, I'm just going to order it on Amazon. It's hard to leave my house with a toddler. But if I am looking for an experience, I am, you know, downtown Downers Grove where I live, wandering around. I went to the knitting store and bought some fancy yarn. I want to walk in. I want to browse. I want to see if I have a question. There's somebody knowledgeable there to help me. I can look at all the covers. I can feel the weight. I love games that have information on the box. There's nothing that drives me more crazy than a two blank box. And I like to pick it up and see. Sometimes they have copies that are open at the store that I can look at the bits, feel the components, and decide. You know, it's like an experience.
So you're kind of jumping to the question of, is this good for the local retail store? Is Amazon good for those local stores?
No. I don't know.
I'm going to say a pretty hardcore no.
Yeah.
But I think it depends on how the stores handle it. So there was one store that I would go to. And the person who worked there, even though they weren't even, they didn't own the store or anything like that. They were just employee of the store. But you can obviously have a vested interest in your employer. They would get irate if someone came in, looked at a game, looked on their phone, obviously bringing up Amazon, checking prices, and then walked out. Like, they would be so upset with both Amazon and the person who did that. And I think, and it was visibly so, like, you know, sometimes they would even say something. It's like, you know, glad you're going to go shop on Amazon, have a good day, you know, those types of things. In that case, I have no problem buying from Amazon. I'd be like, yeah, no problem. Their price is a whole lot cheaper than yours later. But at that same thing, because Amazon, for other things, like Amazon put Best Buy basically, well, at least shrunk Best Buy. Because you walk into a Best Buy and you look at something and you go to Amazon, it's much cheaper and they have reviews and you can check out this stuff. I don't use Amazon board game reviews. BGG just has better reviews. But I will check the price on Amazon. And if it's crazy, crazy different, it is hard to justify buying something in the store for $100 when Amazon's selling it for $60. Like, it's just really hard not to do that. So I think Amazon does hurt stores. And I think that is a problem for stores. And I think that's why local game stores have to do something more than just try to compete on price.
Yes. I don't think that game stores are going to be able to compete on price. And that's kind of the point I was trying to make, is that I don't go to the game store knowing that I'm going to get a good price on a game. I go to the game store for an experience. I know they are providing things to my community that Amazon cannot. They have game nights. They have people there who understand the games. They can teach games. They can do things. And I am willing to pay more for a game at a good game store because I know I am paying the markup for the services. And I think that that needs to be the attitude of more consumers and the attitude of more stores if the local game store is going to continue.
Yeah.
Because if you just keep trying to lower the prices and become a discount game store competing with Amazon, you're not going to be able to.
Yeah.
You need to provide something more.
Yeah, your margins just can't be big enough to support what you need. Or you do what Cool Stuff Inc. did, which was start as a local game store and then create an online presence so that they can sell in a lot bigger volume, which allows them to buy in a lot bigger volume. And then they can actually, you know, sustain their local stores, but their most of their money is being made online. But that's tricky because some people just don't want to do that. They want to focus on their store. And that is also fine. But I understand the frustration that local of all businesses have with Amazon. Amazon's not going away, though. Like, there's nobody's going to be like, you know something? I'm waking up today and I'm just going to stop using Amazon. I'm only going to shop local because I like getting out of my house and, you know, showering before I go shopping and going from to 15 different stores to compare prices and ask a bunch of people about what they think about the products I'm about to buy. I really like doing that. No, it's just not going to happen.
No. And there's another great show I will recommend. I think there's one of her shows is on Netflix. Mary Queen of Shops is the one that I used to watch. But I think it's Mary Portis, Secret Shoppers is on Netflix now. And she goes into stores and like talks to local stores about how to compete with the online market. And her whole thing is all about selling service. Yep. So, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what we should be focused on.
Well, and the thing is,
in gaming as well as in, you know, gosh, she's been in all kinds of stores. I would love to see her do a game store. That would be so much fun.
We should write her and say, hey, we want you to.
Right?
Because I'm the biggest proponent of supporting your local game store.
But, oh, yeah. But you're in your game store all the time. Yeah.
And I will buy, like, there are certain things that I only buy from him. Because I'm like, you know, I could get these cheaper, but I don't care. These things are products I am buying from you. I am spending money with you because I want to support him. Now, that's not everything. I don't get everything there, but whenever I can, I do. And his prices are relatively competitive. I might be paying a few dollar premium, but for the most part, he tries to be as competitive as he can. But your local game store...
Don't you do like all your Arkham Horror stuff through the game store?
All my Arkham Horror, all my Shadespire, pretty much anything Fantasy Flight I will get through him. Just because, and I do a lot of, I like a lot of the Fantasy Flight stuff. So I'll get that through him. And then sometimes if I see a new game, because I don't buy a lot of new games now from game stores directly. I have too many things coming in a Kickstarter where I've already pre-bought most of the stuff.
Yeah.
But anytime I can, I'll buy from him. But local game stores to compete with Amazon, I completely agree. You have to do stuff that Amazon can't do. And you have to build that community and build that loyalty. And that's just like you're not opening a game store to get rich. You're opening a game store because you want to be part of the community.
You're passionate about it.
Yeah. And if you're not passionate about it, just go to Amazon. It'll be easier. All right. Moving on. YouTube. You guys ever watch anything on YouTube?
Yes.
What's YouTube?
For the longest time, I would avoid YouTube. I hated the idea of YouTube, just hated it. It's like people would watch YouTube for hours and hours and hours. I'm like, no, I'm never doing that. Like every once in a while, something would refer me there, and I'd never click on a related link. That has changed.
That's weird.
I know. It's only been the last year and a half where I've actually started using YouTube on a regular basis.
YouTube is great.
Why?
Because you... Like, I use it as, like, a learning portal. Like, I install the ceiling fan, and I'm pretty handy.
Yeah.
But I've never installed a ceiling fan before, so I brought up a video on, like, how to install a ceiling fan, how to install bifold doors, like, the best way to do this, the best way to do that. And there's videos that literally show you how to do it for free.
Yeah.
And that's amazing.
Yep, I talked last week about my setting up a sound recording room and how complicated those things are. That's all YouTube. And like, it just is lost in YouTube and how to use this software and that software and these mics versus that mic. Very opinionated. And they all seem to lead to politics at some point. But that's a whole nother story. Don't click on those. So what do we...
I use it. That's how I taught myself how to knit and crochet effectively, too. That's the best way to do that. YouTube is like the visual learner's dream.
And I'm assuming you've used them for Board Game Rule.
Yes.
Or reviews.
Yep.
So
mostly rules.
Okay. So you're not doing eBay. You're not doing Amazon. But YouTube, absolutely, when it comes to board games. So it sounds like YouTube is a bigger disruptor than eBay and Amazon when it comes to board gaming for you.
Define disruptor.
Yeah, it's not a disruptor.
Influencer.
Influencer, sure. But I don't know that it qualifies as a disruptor.
The other two are marketplaces. YouTube is not a marketplace. Yes. So,
are you sure?
You don't buy anything from YouTube.
But it is an ad platform.
But there are people selling.
Yep.
There are lots of people who are creators who are putting out reviews. They are putting out, you should buy this because kind of content that is driven by ads, and all of them are given the games for free by publishers to say nice things about them. And I think the good reviewers out there, even if they're getting this stuff for free, don't allow that to influence them. But, you know, you've got to really be strict with yourself. You've got to really, like, be honest to be good at this. But I don't think everyone out there is. And I think there are a lot of people out there who are making money just by talking about, you know, whatever somebody's going to give them for free because it gets them ad revenue generated.
Well, and you have to be careful. Paid promotions are paid promotions. And being in a position where people will sometimes say, hey, can you promote this? And I don't think I've ever accepted money for a promotion, but I might have accepted like a prototype or something.
Yeah.
I'm not going to just rip into the game that someone's sending me to try out. I may be critical of things, or I may say, I like this, this, and this, and may not be like, I wholeheartedly endorse this, but it's going to be kind of, you know, set with a little bit of happy talk to it, right? Because, I don't know, you're just kind of in that mode. And a lot of these paid promotions that I see are, you know, people are talking about it. They're very enthusiastic about it. They may never say that I recommend this game or I like this game, but the way you talk about it, that comes across as, oh, this looks like a cool game because they're being enthusiastic about it. All of the links, all of the ads, like YouTube, it disrupts. It's more of an influencer than a disruptor, probably, but it's very influential.
It is very influential. I still, after all of my talk, think it's not actually that disruptive. I think that most people who are out there doing these, even if they're paid promotions, they're very honest with what they're up to.
Yeah. Well,
very straightforward. And you kind of have to be.
Yeah. And hopefully what you're seeing is factual things. So I talk about Rado a lot on this, but the way he does his, he has a final thoughts where he gives you what he thinks. But ultimately, he always says, watch the playthrough. Watch how the game plays, because then you can come away from it and decide if you would like doing that. And you don't have to take my opinion, because I like X, Y, and Z in a game. If you like A, B, and C, you may really like this game, even though I didn't, because it had too much of X or whatever. Samir wrote us and said, between top 10s and everyone and their grandmother doing playthroughs and news feeds and such, YouTube has definitely been a major factor in my exposure to the hobby and many of the niche games that don't show up at Target and Walgreens. He says there's a couple positives. Anyone can make a video. So YouTube gives a lot of exposure to a lot of games that would never have success in the old marketing distribution channels. He says, YouTube gives me a chance to look for playthroughs or rules explanations to help me decide how interested I am in adding it to my collection. I can watch someone else demo a game for me that I would not have a chance to try out for myself. Have you guys watched playthroughs or demos before buying a game before?
Before buying a game? No.
not before buying a game, no.
So I started doing this a lot more when I started pulling back on the Kickstarters. Because then what I would do is I'd watch somebody play, and literal sometimes 1 to 2 hours of watching someone play a board game. And if at the end of it, I liked what I saw and I wanted to do that, then I'd be like, okay, this is something I want to back. Otherwise, if it's like, okay, I saw, it was interesting, and if I played it, I wouldn't play it again. Then I said, oh, I'm not going to back this because I was able to watch this through. It's time consuming, but it saves you a couple $100 every once in a while.
It could also be entertaining too.
Oh yeah. Yep. There are some things that are, it's amazing.
That's like the unboxing videos, right? Like that's a huge thing. People just find that super entertaining.
Yeah. We did one unboxing video and it was fun. I did it twice.
It was. Yeah, we did a double unboxing of Gloomhaven.
Because the first time I forgot to turn the camera on.
Could you get everything then, back in the box?
No.
And he had two copies. Like an insane person.
I accidentally got two copies of Gloomhaven back when it was like super high demand. And we unboxed the first one. And then I forgot to turn the camera on. I was like, okay, whatever. That was just practice talking into the air then. And then another one showed up. And I'm like, all right, we'll unbox this one. So Samir has some negatives here. He says that he sees a double-edged sword here. A playthrough will typically be from a group or person who enjoys the game and may make the game look more enjoyable than he would find it. I would go as far as to say I get to enjoy a game vicariously yeah, through a group and then get a game that I may never get to the table because I don't have the right group for the game. He also feels, sometimes I feel like watching a lot of YouTube videos has led to my evolution of what I want to play race ahead of what others around me want to play. So by doing a lot more research on YouTube, he's saying my taste in games is advancing faster than the people around me. Which I can see. I think anything they become super educated in or super knowledgeable about, you're going to outpace those people around you. And they're like, wait a minute, this makes no sense to me. YouTube, good or bad for the industry?
Good.
Good.
I would say great. Great for the industry.
I think it's awesome. And as much as I've never researched a game before purchasing it, I'm very much an impulse buyer. I like to have things in my hands, which is why I rarely buy things on Amazon. I mostly buy them. I'd say I do a lot of my buying at conventions. Between conventions and Kickstarter, that's where I pick up most of my games. But I watch so many videos on how to play. I will occasionally watch strategy videos. I like to see what other people are doing, how other people are playing the game. And that, to me, makes me so much more willing to pick up a game I don't know very much about because I know I'm going to be able to find out about it. I know that there's no way that I can pick up a popular game and not be able to find 100 videos on YouTube of people willing to teach me how to play that game.
Yeah. Especially if it's popular. Now, if it's unpopular or like little known, you may find nothing about it anywhere. And that's.
And I'm going to go see and then you if can I can make find
one.
Some of my.
Exactly. That's where we come into it today. Let's just make one. But anybody could make one. Work on your audio. That's my biggest advice for YouTube. You can use your phone.
And also any podcast. Podcasts and
YouTube. Audio. You can
use audio is so important.
Yep, you can use your phone for the camera. Your camera and your phone is just as good as any camera you could buy. But audio, you want to get a good microphone. You don't want to record from your camera microphone. It's just don't do that. But if you do, get a good microphone. Just plug it into your phone, and boom, there you go. You can be a YouTuber and help a lot of people out.
All right, Chris, tell me an obscure game from your collection.
An obscure game from my collection. Man, you're putting me on the spot here. I don't have any obscure games.
Not a single obscure game? That's ridiculous.
Well, I probably do, but I'm not able to think of them off the top of my head. And a lot of the obscure games are Kickstarter things. So the videos, like the Kickstarter videos, still show up there.
Yeah.
Let's do the Epic card game.
The Epic card game.
Never heard of it.
That's why, as you said, obscure.
Epic card game. 1, 2, 3, at least 4 or 5 videos on how to play. That's not including reviews or championships. Epic World Championship 2016 semifinals.
Now, the publisher is the same person who does Star Realms, Hero Star, and well, they do Hero Realms, and then why the name is escaping me right now, but they have a number of very successful games. This is probably their least successful, or at least well-known, so that one just kind of popped in my head.
What is the game that I always forget the name of, where it's like Rummy, but it's got the powers, Fantasy Realm? No.
Oh, yeah, Fantasy Realms. Yep.
Are we like live looking up on...
Oh yeah,
YouTube
yeah.
right now to see like, what we're gonna do,
which we're eating into our Kickstarter.
At least
time,
Vamp. That's all right. At least four. Vamp. Okay.
All right, let's go to Kickstarter. Eric Dodd sends us an email, and then Jeremy does a good follow up here. With regards to Kickstarter, Kitty has concerns that big players like CMON has forced all other companies to produce games to the same standard or miss out. I think consumers have become smarter with companies with comparing similar projects, but it's true that flashy projects with an IP and plenty of plastic figures will get the majority of views and funding. All right, we're going to start there. We'll touch on these other things in a little bit. Kickstarter, I'm going to say, is the best thing that ever happened to board games. Hands down, without a doubt. Kickstarter has helped this industry grow exponentially over the past 5 years. It is the biggest, it's the most successful portion of Kickstarter is their board games. They raise the most money. The highest funded project on Kickstarter of all projects across everything on Kickstarter was a board game last year.
Really?
It allows people, and look at and it's not the greatest game in the world, but what the kittens, exploding kittens.
Oh, you know, yeah.
That was like 5 years ago, but $8 million for a card game, a game. Like Kickstarter has allowed people to do things that they would never be able to do otherwise. And to me, like way back, I don't know, about a decade ago, this thing came out called a smartphone. The iPhone came out and it's like, holy crap, what is this? And then this app store came out and where you could download apps. But more importantly, as from a developer standpoint, I could write apps and put them on the app store and people would download my app and they would pay me for this app. Now, granted, Apple took 30%, but up until then, I was spending, you know, 90%+ would go to whoever was distributing it. 30% was an amazing ratio for the developer. And it allowed people to put apps out there to a point where anybody could actually put something out there and be successful. Kickstarter is that same thing for physical board games. And there is no bad, there's no downside to Kickstarter as far as I can tell. Like, yes, every once in a while, a project is going to fail, isn't going to fund, or isn't going to fulfill even, which is the worst case scenario. Those things are such exceptions that I can't even say that they're bad. Yes, it sucks when it happens, but that is no reason that the platform is bad. All right, that's my rant. What do you guys think?
So I think that as a whole, Kickstarter has revolutionized publishing games. You can't argue with that at all. I do think now, though, that as much as Kickstarter changed game publishing, big game publishers have changed Kickstarter. When you are putting out games, you're looking at the Kickstarter list of games. You've searched by tabletop games. You're looking at it. There's a huge game from CMON in there. They've got now Throw Burrito from the makers of Exploding Kittens, who are already wildly successful and popular and have tons and tons of money. They don't need Kickstarter. It should not be a pre-order system where you get to put on fancy stuff. That's not what it's for. And I think that it draws away attention. So if you're comparing it to the App Store, you're looking at these apps, you know, maybe this is a bad analogy, but like, you know, these games that are being put out, like, you know,
Kitty, I agree with you. Crazy. I'll save you. So what you're saying
thank
is
you. Like, I'm drowning. I lost my analogy.
For an established company that has a track record, and not only that, but a storefront for publishing
and the
games
resources.
And the resources, they do not need a Kickstarter. They don't need to launch a Kickstarter edition of their next game. And like you said, this is basically a pre-order system for that company. While it could be crowding out the smaller independent games and game publishers that are actually using Kickstarter as a way to fund their game.
As it is meant to be used.
As the idea of Kickstarter is meant to be. It's used to kickstart what otherwise would not have happened.
So, we mentioned CMON a lot. And I know you guys don't know this, so I just want you to kind of guesstimate. What do you think that Kickstarter or that CMON's annual revenue was last year? Just how much money they brought in?
I have no idea.
Gosh, I have no idea.
So when you say, all right, so let's see. The last Zombicide raised $2 million. Mm-hmm. Are they 10 times that size, 20 times that size?
I don't know.
Okay. So
tell me what you're trying to get at.
Last year, I think they grossed like $25 million, something like that.
Okay.
And they're one of the larger companies in the industry. $25 million company is nothing. It's like, as far as other companies are concerned, even CMON cannot fund a print run of $2 million worth of Zombicide. They can't. They don't have that much money. Most of the money goes into making the game. They have relatively small margins. Nobody is getting crazy rich. Like Kickstarter as a pre-order platform, I think it's ridiculous any company that doesn't use it as a pre-order platform. If Wingspan had been kickstarted, there would be no worry of supply. Why did Wingspan have under supply? Because Jamie had no idea what the demand was going to be. Kickstarter's not just about pre-ordering. It's not just about kickstarting. It's not just about making someone's dreams come true. It can do that, but it's about letting companies know what the demand is out there and getting feedback from users early on.
I just don't think that's true. I think that if a company like Simon is not able to trade on credit to publish to get these games made, that's not a good industry. And we are fueling a system of lies. We're not I don't know.
A good industry. The board game industry is not a good industry. It is a niche industry. All I know is
that when you are looking at these games and the production value that is going into them and how many people, if they are routinely pre-ordering out $2 million on not just one campaign a year, but several campaigns throughout a year, like if they're not making enough money to make more games after making that much money, they are like a bad company. I don't know. Like that doesn't make any sense to me. What I see is that if you have CMON out there and that is you pull up Kickstarter, it is their headline, it is their big check me out, sorted by magic, top of the list game all the time, then you're not going to look down 30 games and you're not going to see the person who doesn't have final art on their project, who doesn't have a produced video. And if you do scroll all the way down to see that person, you're going to say, this game looks like garbage compared to the video that has been put out by this big company. And CMON doesn't not fulfill its projects.
So
they have it play tested. They have it ready to go. Like there's going to be a delay, but it is an expected manufacturer delay. It is not a, like I am supporting somebody who can't do this without me.
But I think it is okay that the bar has been raised, because I am not going to get something from the non-produced video, the non-finished game. If you can't afford to actually create a prototype of your game to show on your Kickstarter page, your game isn't ready. It's not ready to be Kickstarted. And that is okay. It's okay to not to be ready. Take some extra time, flesh out that design. There are many people out there that will do videos for you. You have to have a little bit of money there to have a successful Kickstarter campaign. And I don't think there's a problem with that. There are too many games out there anyway, and it's a good filter to say, let's get to a certain base quality before you go out there and ask people to give you money for your game.
The website that you are describing, I don't mind if it exists. I just don't think it should be Kickstarter.
Okay.
If it's like a pre-order platform where established companies with play-tested games can get out there and put it out where, you know, everyone can like, oh, I would like my copy. I will pay in advance. We can know how much the demand is. That's fine. That to me is not the spirit of Kickstarter. To me, the spirit of Kickstarter or Indiegogo or any of these other websites where it is supposed to be a crowdfunding of a project that might fail
When do we ban CMON from Kickstarter and why?
We shouldn't ban them, but like, I don't know. Like, it just annoys me.
Okay.
I have no solution. I just want to like point out what I see as a problem.
I want to get some input from other people as well. So Jeremy Fisher has a thought on Kickstarter. They are big enough to be a publisher. They should talk to small developers and help them kickstart their games. When CMON shows up on a Kickstarter, they can talk about the game and the developer's passion. This could help small developers quite a bit, as putting the game out on Kickstarter doesn't automatically guarantee funding anymore. You have a reaction to that?
If you are a publisher and you are helping a smaller person who has a single game put out their game, that's what you should be doing as a publisher. If you are publishing a game for a designer, that's the system working. I don't know. Like, if you are a publisher, your job is to publish games. You shouldn't need Kickstarter to publish them. If you are an independent game designer who would like to put out your game individually, that is what Kickstarter is for.
All right, so Terrence added a quote from James Hudson in here. He says, CMON did a lot of work to build the game market on Kickstarter, and it's a channel that works for them. So why wouldn't they continue to make use of it? Why is it that Kickstarter has used it so well that they shouldn't be allowed to use it anymore?
Because now they've established themselves as a company. They can, like, I don't know, like, why, if I'm trying to think, all right, if Ford started putting out their new models of cars on Kickstarter, I'd be mad.
Well, bicycle, speaking not of cars, but of cards, the Bicycle, which is one of the most, well, probably the most famous brand of cards, does all of their specialty cars on Kickstarter now. All of them. They never started there. So another thing to think about with Kickstarter is, Kickstarter, if CMON were to stop using Kickstarter, they would probably, end up going out of business. Kickstarter is so important for the board game industry of companies of all sizes, as such as a promotion platform, as a pre-order platform, as an estimate to do whatever they want to do platform, that you can't go away from it. And for better or worse, I understand what Kickstarter was started to for, but today in the board game industry, it's not that anymore. And it will never be that again.
The board game corner of Kickstarter is completely unique to the rest of Kickstarter.
Oh, yeah. I'm talking just to the board game corner.
I know. Yeah. And that's, it's just so baffling to me that like this has become what it is. I just like, I don't know. It just gets on my nerves. Like there's something about it that like makes my skin crawl that I feel like, I don't know that like, I don't know. I feel like it's the big bank like putting on the like, oh, check it out. Our local branch is hiring local people. Like, don't look at us. And like, you're Chase. You're Chase Bank. Don't put it in a cute little building and pretend like you're not Chase Bank. I don't know.
I think the scale is a little different there.
Yes.
Fletcher, do you have any
using hyperbole?
We're playing ping pong with you right now. What do you have any input on this?
Well, I mean, I kind of agree with Kitty. I understand where you're coming from. Like Kickstarter has evolved into a pre-order platform. I have not pre-ordered any games on Kickstarter or backed any games on Kickstarter. But I remember looking through Kickstarter just for other things, and the thing that strikes me is like Casper, the mattress company. I think I talked about this before. Mm-hmm. They mm-hmm. had a duvet cover, but they had like a blanket that they were selling, and it was a Kickstarter.
The weighted blanket thing, or is this a different thing?
I don't think it was a weighted blanket, but it was by Casper.
Okay.
It's an already successful company. They sell mattresses online
mm-hmm.
and pillows and other things. How you can even buy, you know, their pillows in the store, but this was for a blanket that they were selling. And it just kind of irked me, and I was like, why are they kickstarting a blanket on this platform? Like, they're a big enough company. They're in Target. Like, I don't understand what they need Kickstarter for.
So, same
thing. I saw Logitech do the same thing. And it just kind of rubs me the wrong way. And, like, you know, one
so
way
is
smooth. So I can
tell you why they do it. They do it because, yes, they're a relatively big company. And they have products that they know will sell. But maybe the blanket won't.
Why they do it. I understand why.
It makes sense for them financially. I get it.
I get it. I just don't want it to
happen. It minimizes their personal risk. It minimizes the risk of the company. It's just like that's what being a company is about.
But no. You guys are splitting hairs where the hairs don't need to be split. So if I were to spin off, if I was working at Casper and I'm like, I have this great idea for a blanket. And Casper's like, okay, look, we would love to do that. But if we put this on Kickstarter, you know, Fletcher and Kitty are going to be really upset about this. So we're going to spin you off into your own small company so you look like you're a startup. And then you're going to put up this, you know, early version of this weighted blanket on Kickstarter. We're going to see how it does. And if it does great, we'll buy you back and we're going to put all our effort into making this blanket even more successful. You would be okay with that because now it's just some small guy saying, hey, I have this idea for a blanket. But
no, now I'm even less okay with it.
But you don't know that, and that's equivalent.
I don't know it, but like, but I think that that's shady business, and I don't think that we should be condoning that.
What I'm saying is,
regardless of whether or not we know about it when it's happening.
What I'm saying is, if Joe Nobody were to put this blanket up there, you'd be fine. But if a bigger company is like, hey, I want to see if this product has legs, if people are interested in this, this is not okay. And that's where I think we're splitting hairs. I don't know. All I know is board game publishers do not make enough money to front load these games. And what people think, where CMON is just this huge publisher, they're not. They are a tiny little company who could not do what they do without Kickstarter. So the fact is like, oh, their campaigns are successful. That just goes to show that they put a lot of time and effort into their campaigns and they want to make them successful. Without them, though, the company wouldn't exist anymore. And it sounds like we were saying, once you're successful, you're not allowed to do the things that made you successful anymore. You have to stop doing those. And that doesn't make sense to me.
I think that it's not that they do campaigns for their games. I think it is how they do campaigns, how often they do campaigns. And honestly, if you're seriously telling me that they cannot afford to make their games, I don't know how the industry works and I need to learn more about it, perhaps. But seriously, that is a huge problem. Yeah.
So typically how the industry...
A company that is like working on forward credit, that like you're telling me they can't get a loan from a bank? That's how companies work, I thought. Like,
but the thing is,
why are they getting loans straight from people if they are an established enough company that has proven that they've got these orders coming that they can't do that?
Okay, so let's take a look at Stonemaier Games. Stonemaier Games is about two-thirds the size of CMON Games, which is to say Stonemaier Games, revenue-wise, makes a ton of money. CMON makes a little bit more. And by a ton of money, I mean, I think Stonemaier releases actual numbers, but they're in like the teens of millions. And CMON is about double, triple that.
That's what they make, or that's...
That's their revenue. Gross. Okay. Like, not, you know, for not just balanced, a sales number. Yeah. Right. So, when Jamie decided to put out Wingspan, he had 5,000 copies made up. Because that's a typical print run for a medium-sized board game. And the 5,000 copies is still a ton of investment. And you have to sell all of those copies. If you sell 1,000 of those, and you've just made 5,000, you've just... Stonemaier might be able to absorb that, but a typical game company, a smaller game company, that might be enough to put them out of business. So you have to make small print runs. And these games may never get made again, which happens a lot. AEG does a lot of, you know, Kickstarters for deluxified versions of games that were popular, even though they made a small print run at the beginning, because like, okay, now we need to make a bigger print run, but we don't have the funds to do that. Most of these publishers are run by part-time people spread out all remotely. There is no giant CMON building. It just doesn't... Well, CMON's a little bit different, but they're in Singapore, and it's a small CMON building. They probably have shared office space, to be honest. But in any case, they're too small to take those kind of risks. So that's where Kickstarter allows them to say, hey, look, you had 10,000 people that were willing to back this. You can bet on a certain amount that will sell afterwards. So maybe make 15,000 copies of this game. And that,
so are they making profits on those games?
They're making profits on the games, but just enough to pay
for
the development.
Are they making lots of...
They're not... They make profits, but those profits aren't necessarily enough to roll into the next game. Because everybody in the industry, like all of us consumers, we want games to be as cheap as possible. Oh my goodness. I'm spending $75 for a game. That's crazy. It should have this, 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 and this, and this. And the margins are just so small.
That's a bad business model.
Getting into board games is a bad business model, which is why I think that Kickstarter is the most important thing that's ever happened to this industry. It allows us games that would have never, ever, ever seen the light of day in any other situation because they don't have to take that risk up front. I can say, are people interested? If they are, great. I make a bunch of games. If not, okay, I didn't actually put out a ton of money. I didn't lose a ton. I just lost what I wanted to do for my media coverage. And that's
so does Stonemaier Games use Kickstarter?
He does not use Kickstarter. He did at the beginning. He doesn't use it anymore because people on Kickstarter are a-holes. And
so he can make it work without using Kickstarter?
He's a very rare exception, and he has an entire blog post on exactly how he can make it work. He's a very rare exception to it, though. The reason he can make it work is because he has that reputation. Most new developers and even, you know, Most new developers don't.
It's so great that they can use Kickstarter. Companies like CMON, if they are not getting themselves to the point where they can be self-sufficient, I just don't think that, like, that doesn't make sense to me. Either they are, like, rolling themselves forward, they are using this momentum that they have to make more money, to trade on their reputation, to get themselves to be a standalone business, and it will make more sense for them to not need this. Like, Kickstarter should be a crutch to get people started. It should be something to launch people into a career. If this is your career, if you are full-time doing this, and you have done years and years of successful campaigns and you can't produce a print run, I just don't know if you have a workable business model. And like, that makes me insane.
You are 100% correct. That is the business model of board game companies. 100%.
Not all of them.
Almost
there are so
all
many,
of them.
It makes me crazy that like, oh my gosh. And now there's like more established brands that are getting onto Kickstarter because that's now how you buy games. And it's just like, it's making it not what it was supposed to be, and it's making it just like the Amazon of board games. And like when things don't fulfill now, when they don't fulfill on time, and people act like it didn't come out on my pre-order date, how dare they? And they get mad about it, and they are jerks about it. It's because these big companies are using it as their personal sales website and not as what it is.
Okay. We're going to have to stop talking about this, but I am curious what people think on this, because obviously there it is passionate. Actually, we should do a topic on how the board game industry works, because I do think that's something that most people don't understand. There's a lot of people out there, like a lot of these companies, you would be surprised. Some of them, big companies that you would think are big companies, have zero full-time employees. Like, it's a part-time business on the side type of thing. And how they stay in business is the pre-order model and those types of things. Now, there are exceptions, but they are very, very few and far between exceptions. You know, your board game designers, 99% of them are working a full-time job. And has nothing to do with board games. So it's just a different industry. It's not a good business model. There's no good business model behind board games. It just doesn't exist. So I agree that Kickstarter should be there to help the little guy, but I don't think the big guy, quote unquote big guy, should be penalized and not be allowed to use a platform that basically sustains their business model. It's a tricky thing. And there's obviously passions on both sides. So from the store perspective, though, I will say from the store perspective, Kickstarter has to be miserable, because if I can't go, even with the Kickstarters that have retail pledges, as a store owner, I can't say, okay, I'm going to back this Kickstarter, even though I'm going to get 50% off, I'm going to get 5 copies, 6 copies, whatever, and then have to wait a year plus before I can actually sell my Kickstarter. That sucks.
Well, not if they're from CMON, because you know they're going to fulfill, and you know they're going to fulfill quickly, and you know they're going to sell in stores if you get the Kickstarter exclusive. Like, that's...
Sure.
I don't know.
And that's great. And CMON has that reputation. But... CMON's not the only one out there. CMON, I don't think, is the problem on Kickstarter. I don't think actually there is that big of a problem on Kickstarter. I think outside of the game section in Kickstarter, you have a much bigger problem. I have Kickstarters, things that I've invested in Kickstarter that are non-game related, that are 4 or 5 years old and still haven't fulfilled. That doesn't happen on the board game side. And when it does, it's such a rarity. And that's, we come to expect that Kickstarter on the board game side is a pre-order platform. It's not something that's just going to, you know, we're just going to fund it and then we're going to go away. It doesn't happen. And when it does, it's everyone hears about it. But ratio wise, it's just not there. Okay. All right. What do you guys think about this? Kickstarter. Are Kitty or me? Who agrees with who? let's be...
Somewhere in between.
Yeah.
We've taken extreme points.
Yeah. And especially if you're a retailer, I would love to hear your point of view on this as well. Like I say, my view is I don't think there should be any restrictions to what game companies are doing on Kickstarter. It helps great games come out. Of the top 20 games on BGG right now, 25% of them are Kickstarters. I expected that number to be more, but it's 25%, with the number one game of all time being a Kickstarter game, according to BGG. These games wouldn't have existed without Kickstarter. But and Kitty's view is that Kickstarter is great. Just keep it to the small... needy new developers, as opposed to those who have established that they can, you know, create successful games, which maybe.
I think that, like, it should just, like, the expectation should be to roll out of Kickstarter eventually and not just to, I don't know, linger forever.
I think that's that expectation. And honestly, CMON, last year, that's what they did. They started rolling out of Kickstarter. They started just doing more direct to sales. Their year over year was $15 million loss. That's what happened when they rolled out of Kickstarter, is they shrunk by like...
Sounds like 20... they have a bad business.
It is board games. All board game industries are bad
businesses. No, you know what it sounds like to me? It sounds like a bad Facebook business, where the more money they pump into Facebook, the more sales they get, and they're completely dependent on Facebook for sales. And if it wasn't for Facebook, they don't have a business. Yep. Right. That's what it sounds like to me.
But that's how CMON got to where they got, was using Kickstarter.
And yeah, it sounds like they don't have a business. It sounds like they have an idea.
Kickstarter is their business model.
It's not a good business model, though.
All right. Let's go to listener mail. Fletcher, you're first.
Oh, I'm so excited to have an ally.
I'm not as passionate as Kitty, but I mean, I kind of...
You're just not as insane as me. That's fine. But your listener mail.
Yes, my listener mail. I need to scroll to find it. Where is it? Someone prompt me. Okay, here we go. So Samir emailed, and he said, wedding tip for Fletcher. Nothing to do with board games. And he wrote to me and he said, this tip was given to me just prior to my first wedding, and I have passed it on to every groom I have known since. Contact a florist local to your wedding and have them send your bride a bouquet in the morning of the wedding with a note from you reflecting on why you're getting married. If you're a traditionalist, you will not have seen your wife-to-be for nearly a day, and it will be a token of affection in the midst of a hectic emotional morning for her. If you can't get a local florist, just get a bouquet and one of your groomsmen deliver it and have them deliver the flowers for you. I think this is a great idea, and I will probably end up doing this.
I love it. I would have loved this.
Yeah, we never, Sydney and I, like, basically, I think we saw each other up until like 3 hours before, like, once she got dressed, I hadn't seen, because I didn't see the dress up until, but we were on a ship. I was giving her, I don't know, a drink packet? Does that count? Here, drink this. All right, Kitty.
All right. I got some email from Dan, and he was commenting on, I've been looking for a family-friendly D&D podcast. And he says, I hear you. Finding a family-friendly D&D stuff is a pain. I'm really enjoying Titans of Altera, which is one that's committed to being family-friendly. I have listened to both, I think, for like the first two episodes. And I like it. It's fun. It does border on being like too family-friendly for me. I'm looking for a really weird spot. But it is way better than some of the ones that, like, they're not using, like, oh, I'm using my kid voice to sound like I'm a cool person who kids identify with. So at least there's that.
So it's not too family-ish, but it's still not quite. It's PG, not PG-13. I just want something like,
yeah, I want PG-13, but at least it's not G.
Yeah. let's see. I got an email from Jerry way back on February 20th. Sorry, Jerry. This is why we're doing listener.
Yeah.
Mail. He says, you guys have tried the Covenant podcast, video cast for Keyforge? He says, I mentioned no good Keyforge podcast, so I wondered if I checked them out. He says, I found them pretty good, and you might have missed them since they don't solely focus on Keyforge. And he says that I am still the best about hyping Keyforge because I love Keyforge. And I also, the Covenant podcast is one of those podcasts I discovered by looking for Keyforge podcasts. The Covenant podcast, I've mentioned a couple times now. This whole episode sprung out of listening to their podcast. They have a game store, and they do a podcast around, you know, the different subjects of that. Their format has changed over time. Oftentimes they talk about, you know, specific games and such. Like, they'll talk about Keyforge, they'll talk about Star Wars Destiny, X-Wing, those types of things. But they have started doing more topical stuff, kind of like what we do as well, but from a retailer perspective, you know, running organized play and things like that. So it is a really cool podcast. They do, they set up a camera and do a video cast. So they're sitting at a table and they're doing a podcast with live on video as well. So you can get it on YouTube or you can get it on any kind of podcast thing. So I like it and it's good. It's worth checking out. Okay. Wow, this was a passionate episode. I liked it. Wait, this Kickstarter, send us an email about Kickstarter, because it does seem to be very polarizing, and there's a lot of people that are, you know, on one side or the other. I do think that next week, though, I think we're going to do an episode on how the board game industry works behind the scenes, as kind of a tail to this. And not talking specifically about Kickstarter, but talking about how people make money in the industry. Like, how do publishers make money? How do designers make money? Is there any money to be had? Those types of things. And we'll do a lot of research on this one. I'm going to dig into it and get some actual stats and numbers wherever I can. And maybe some quotes from people that are actually in the industry. Okay. If you would like to follow us on Facebook, you can @ Tabletop Game Talk Podcast. Twitter is Tabletop Game TLK. Kitty's Lawful Good Mom. Fletch is Net Fletch. Fletch is Net Fletch. That works. And I am Game Master Chris. Patreon. We're trying to get 65 patrons. So I think I don't know as of this airs how much we are. But if it's 65 already, then next week we will have a drawing for a game. Wanderer, The Cult of Barnacle Bay. But if we are 65, keep going, because we're going to get cool stuff at 100, I think. 100, we're going to do some really crazy stuff. We are in the talks of doing really, really cool things. And by the time this airs, there will be a discussion that Sydney and I are going to have about a Keyforge tournament that we just came back from. So that'll be one of our first Kickstarter exclusive contents, which will...
Patreon
exclusive content.
Kickstarter.
We've been talking about Kickstarter too much.
Kickstarter's in my brain.
Indiegogo.
Yeah. Which is a terrible place to raise money. Sadly, it's just, it doesn't have the same. Anyway, Kitty, go before I start talking about Kickstarter again.
Tabletop Game Talk is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. Thanks for listening, and remember, we love your feedback. So email us with comments or questions about today's topic at feedback@tabletopgametalk.com.
Finally, a huge thank you to our patrons. George, Adam Harrison, the SGC, Thomas Acciaretti, Jason Strong, Terrence Miltner, Steven Seitz, Michael Ohl, Brian Arnold, Sean P. Kelly, C. Marie, Rudy Liu,
Benjamin Heimowitz, Jerry Huang, Stephen Phillips, Caleb O'Brien, Jennifer Engelbrecht, Justin Willard, Christopher Dong, Jason Marks, Jeremy Fisher, David Radke, Nick Quickstra, David Sellers, Jason Rodney, Michael Yanikowski, Miles Clark, Cindy Lum, Phil Schwartzel, Ann Reynolds,
Eric Hoffman, Adrian Dong, Christopher Vincent, Nate Vaz, Wintham Sean Peck, Eric Seelander, Mike Smith, Trevor Davis, Wesley Trailer, Tim Verdig, Chris Lowe, Joe Hoover, Timothy Gross, Glenn Cotter, Jesse Wolkowiak, Barry Peterson, Ben Gary, email
Gary.
Gary, email Emil, Jewel Jacobson, Marina Stevens,
Brady
Meltzer, yep. Gregory Huber, and Don Gilstrap. Until next week, keep playing games and having fun.
I got so passionate about Kickstarter that I woke up the baby, apparently.
It's a very passionate subject. I didn't realize.
I know. Spencer had to text me and be like, chill.